Hello and welcome to Inside Education with me, Sean Delaney. Inside Education brings you the world of education from an Irish perspective. You can get in touch with the programme through Twitter at Inside Ed, by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or through the programme's website insideed.com. We've been hearing a lot recently about programmes for government and new ministers. Among them was a new Minister for Education and Skills. Congratulations to Richard Bruton. In order to mark the occasion, I decided to interview someone who was a special advisor to a previous Minister for Education and Skills, Rory Quinn. Prior to his tenure as Minister, Rory Quinn's advisor, my guest was Education Editor of the Irish Independent. Since leaving the post, he also authored a book published by Penguin Ireland about his experience, titled An Education, How an Outsider Became an Insider and Learned What Really Goes On in Irish Government. I'm talking about John Walsh, and I spoke to him about his career as an education journalist and as special advisor in education. I even hoped he might have some advice to give the special advisor to the new Minister for Education and Skills. I'll bring you the interview over 2 weeks. This week, John describes how he became an education journalist, how he made the transition from education editor to ministerial special advisor, and what each job involved. When I met up with John Walsh, I began by asking him what the work of a special advisor to a Minister for Education involves.
It involves quite a lot of different activities. I mean, it depends to some extent on the minister. I mean, some ministers really want a gopher. Some ministers want genuine advice from their advisors. Some ministers want kind of a liaison with other politicians, officials, and kind of the wider constituents in the particular area that they're in. So it depends to a large extent on the minister, and to a lesser extent on the ex-advisor himself or herself.
And what did Rory Quinn want?
As he said, he was 3 years spokesperson on education, and he knew sort of the broad contours. But he said to me that, look, he needed somebody to fill in the details. He needed to know the lie of the land. He needed to know who he could deal with, who he could talk to, who the players were, because there's a multiplicity of organisations in the education area, a vast number. Some of them he can deal with very efficiently and effectively and get things done. Some of them will take forever. They'll talk, but they'll take forever to get anything done. He really needed somebody who knew it from the inside.
And you filled that role because you had a lot of these people in your address book as education editor of the Irish Independent.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, he joked that he was going to put up my contacts book on eBay and see how much money he get for it. But now, look, I was very fortunate. The job that I had as education correspondent and editor for the Irish Independent, before that with the Irish Times, and I also wrote for some international publications. So I was really very fortunate in my career up to that point, and then got even more fortunate when he asked me to be his advisor. It was the most exhilarating, exhausting and exciting time I ever had.
And your preparation for that, apart from your work as an education correspondent and editor, you also had a master's in education, is that right?
I did, yeah. I did an MA with Anya Highland in UCC and wrote a book about it, which, like all education books, didn't sell very well. Education books don't. But I was also fortunate in that I worked for the OECD for a while on 4 education reports. So that's when I had some international experience as well. I could bring that to bear on the job.
Because that's unusual that an education correspondent would also have a background in studying education.
It probably is. Yes, I hadn't thought of that, but it probably is, yeah. I came from a family where education was very important. I was very fortunate. And my late father had, unusually in his day and age, had gone to university, started doing an arts and science degree in UCG, as it was then. Didn't finish it because he left to join the Irish Air Corps. But it was very unusual in those days for somebody of his generation to go to university. It was even slightly unusual when I went to university quite a long time ago. I think in the whole country at the time I went to university, there were 17,000 students in the whole country. And there are now more than 17,000 in Galway alone.
And what did you study?
I did a BA and a HDIP. I taught briefly, and probably badly for a while, in an overcrowded classroom in primary school. In those days, when you're doing the dip, you could do your teaching practice in sixth class in primary school. So that's how I ended up in a primary school.
And how did you become education correspondent then initially? Or how did you get into journalism?
Well, I always liked reading and writing. I was always writing. And when I was in college, I used to write for various college publications. And in those days, the newspapers were starting off what they call university notes. And I managed to write university notes for the Irish Times and for the Sunday Independent. I didn't tell one I was writing for the other, because you just get a byline from our UCG correspondent. So they never knew who this other mysterious correspondent was. But they paid me guineas every week that something appears, which is very, very useful for the normal pursuits of drinking that students indulge in occasionally. So it was a very useful experience, and I wrote some pieces for the local newspaper, for which I never got paid, so I haven't teased them about, but no, again, I wrote for the experience of it, and for various other publications, because I was mad keen on getting into journalism more than I was into teaching. So I was fortunate to get a job in the Independent. I came in as kind of a token graduate. The Irish Times at that stage had a graduate recruitment programme, but they had their fill of graduates, so I didn't get in there. I got into the Independent as one of their first graduates, and a very, very raw recruit, and they kept me on. I did general reporting for about a year and a half. I was writing, sort of gravitating towards the education area, because my grandmother had been a primary school principal, and she was got me interested in education. And other members of my extended family had been involved in teaching. So I was interested in the area, just liked the area as a possible specialism. Didn't think about becoming an education journalist. I was asked to become one, but I said, no, I needed more experience as a reporter to know how to write stories, to detect what a story actually is. So they put me on the Herald, which was a wonderful training. So I was sent out to the usual fires and accidents and tragedies of various kinds. And it was a steep learning curve.
And when did the transition come then to being full-time in education?
Well, sometime after I joined the paper, after this training on the Herald, they said, look, we'll try you on this education beat for a while. So I started on it a long, long time ago, liked it and stayed at it. I'm very fortunate to have done so, because it was a very enjoyable and fascinating career. I mean, you really meet very interesting people in the education area. You meet very altruistic people and idealistic people. It's an area that draws sort of the best people to it. And that's the one thing that really attracted me, to meet so many people with ideals who want to make a difference in a classroom or in a lecture hall or in education politics or whatever.
Did you have any role models, or, you know, who were you succeeding, or who was there anyone that was inspiring you?
Well, at the time, there hadn't been an education correspondent in the Independent. At the time, John Horgan and Michael Heaney, John subsequently became the first professor of journalism and then press ombudsman, and Michael Heaney, who subsequently joined RTÉ, they were doing education reporting for the Irish Times, and I suppose they were my role models. They were two particularly good education journalists, and I was very much the neophyte, but they were very helpful to me in helping me. Like, I had to kind of plough my own furrow as well and develop sort of my own contacts and try to develop the area as best I could, you know. I was fortunate that it suits me, I think.
And what did you look for when you were looking for a good education story? What are the ingredients?
Well, something that will grab the reader's imagination. I remember one news editor saying to me, I came to him one day with something I thought was really interesting. And he said, John, there are tomes and tomes of very interesting information in the library in Trinity College. But that means people are going to read them. You really want to write something that people will read. And you write it in a way that grabs their attention in the first few words. And you try to hold it. And you write, as another news editor told me, for your aunt down the country, who doesn't have a huge amount of interest in what you're writing, but you need to grab her attention. So I was always conscious of that you need to grab people's attention and try to hold it through the length of the article, which can be difficult enough.
Because it seems unusual to me that, given the number of people who are involved in the education sector, I mean, apart from the people working in it, but students at different levels of the education system and so on, it doesn't seem to have the same amount of space in any media compared to if you take something like crime or something like court reports or, you know, financial matters or trade union matters even.
I'm not sure I'd agree with you. I mean, over the years, my colleagues from the UK, who I meet at various conferences abroad, or in Ireland, we're constantly surprised at the space we give to education in the Irish media. I actually think we give a lot of space to education material in the Irish media. We perhaps give too much to exam coverage. We can come to that. We give a lot to the CAO. We give a lot to running battles between the departments, the department, or various departments indeed, and the teacher unions. I mean, both the Independent and the Times have two education pages every week. So RTE is a full-time education correspondent. So I think we give a lot of space to education, certainly more than papers in other countries do.
And what was your typical day like then, particularly when you moved on to education editor? What was a typical day?
I didn't start to work too early. People were bemused about, but I started at 10 o'clock, but I was still one of the first in the office. Probably would stay on a bit later than most people would. It was not a 9-to-5 job. Basically, around the phone calls to see was there anything happening. If you didn't have a diary engagement, if there wasn't a press conference that you were attending, or I'd arrange to meet people, or you might get a tidbit of information from somebody and you try to build it up. I mean, the grand conspiratorial leak is a rare enough bird. It's most information that journalists get is you know, little bits of information that you can compile, and you suddenly realise you're onto something, and then you go to somebody else, they'll add a bit more to it. So to some extent, it's like a bit of detective work in some cases. I used to love getting documentation, and so I get on to various, look at various committees or review groups and try to convince one of them to give me a look at a report in advance, or at least tell me what was in it. That's sort of my forte. I used to enjoy that part of it, trying to convince people to give me stuff. I had one particular contact, I used to call him Deep Throat, which always bemused him. He was the head of a particular education organisation that was never in the news, but he, across his desk would come all these fascinating reports, and he had a mischievous streak in him and a good sense of humour. So he'd ring me up and say, "Listen, Walshy, you never got such and such a report. The hell's the matter with you? You're slipping as usual." So I'd have to go through the ritual. I'd say, "Oh God, look, I missed that. Look, any chance of having a look at it?" "No, no, that's a terrible thing to do." So I'd have to go through more ritual of pleading with them. And eventually he'd say, "Okay, come and collect it." So he'd leave it for me at a particular place and I would go and collect it. And then there'd be the usual ritual denunciation of it when it appeared, and he would join that denunciation. "So this is dreadful. We must have an investigation to how this report got out." So he enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm sure if you could reveal everything, it would be a fascinating story. So you were doing all of this work and you got a phone call from Rory Quinn.
I did, yeah. He shortly after he was appointed. And I'd known Rory, obviously, all the time he was spokesperson. I suppose we were the same generation, children and grandchildren at the same stage. I would have met him. We'd have a lot of the same views on a lot of issues. I wasn't a member of any party, never had joined any party. So he asked me to meet him in Boswell's. So I did. It was rather strange. It was an afternoon. So he asked me there and then would I become his advisor. I mean, I didn't have to think very long about it, but I really had to think about, God, such considerations as pension, because I was at the stage of my life where I wouldn't have to worry about that. So how would that be affected? So I took a few days to sort that out with the Independent, which was very generous to me in letting me go to work with the government. So I jumped right in. There was no training, which I think is a pity. There's no training for special advisors. It has now been recommended. I really think there should be, as I think special advisors suffer from not having a couple of days preparation, because you're really thrown in at the deep end. And I suppose I was fortunate in that, because of my journalism, I was familiar with some of what goes on in Leinster House, and I'd be familiar with a lot of the politicians, obviously. But the nuts and bolts of memos to cabinet, how they're filtered, e-cabinet, the confidential electronic access to cabinet papers, how memos work, you know, the whole question of getting observations from government departments, who compiles the observations, you know, the whole question of dealing with PQs, as they're called, parliamentary questions. You know, a two-day session would be very useful, I think, in preparing special advisors for what is a really busy job.
And you're relating to the full-time or the long-established civil servants who are there. How does that relationship work?
Well, again, it depends on the individual. I tried to avoid a mistake made by one predecessor who went to a meeting of the assistant principals and told them all that they were lucky to have a job, that if half of them were in the public service, they'd be sacked. And so I tried to avoid...
through the private sector.
So I thought, no, that would not be a very diplomatic way of dealing with my new colleagues. But it depends on the individual. In my case, I suppose it would be naturally a slight suspicion of a journalist coming in and confidentiality. In the first week, I was looking at six confidential reports on my desk. I mean, all of them would have made lead stories and got me television and radio exposure for a week, you know. But I couldn't tell anybody about them, obviously. So you really had to learn to keep stum with my colleagues, because they would ring me up and try to give us a story, but I would just say no. Political correspondents who I know obviously would ring me up and say, listen, Johnny, you're reading e-cabinet material, this is the stuff that comes up on cabinet for the next week, what's coming up next week. I didn't do it, I just said no. So they soon learned it's not going to be any use to them whatsoever. So it wasn't.
Nice.
Yeah. So I think the officials realised was nothing leaking, and I got on very well with them for the most part. Yeah. I mean, you disagree with one or two of them, but there'd be healthy disagreements. There wouldn't be fights, you know.
And what was a typical day like?
Well, I tried to can be realistic about it. I tried to confide to a 10-hour day as far as I could, because you do reach a stage where you're not productive after that. So I'd be in around 8:30, leave at 6:30. I didn't do lunches or dinners, because you just have a succession of meetings and endless phone calls and emails and stuff to read. So you just turn down invitations to most things. Sometimes you obviously have to go to Leinster House, and if it's a late session, and hang around for that. And there's a lot of meetings up in government buildings, and I was trying to time it. I mean, walking to Leinster House would take about 12 minutes from Marlborough Street, 12, 15 minutes, and inevitably you'd meet somebody and they'll delay you. So that's a half an hour gone. So I said, bloody hell, I'll join the Dublin bike scheme. So I used to cycle up to Leinster House, government buildings, a lot. I saved a lot of time. And I remember there was one occasion I had literally had budget stuff in my pocket from our the education budget, a couple of days before the budget. And some journalist, political journalist, stopped me and said, "Ah," so I stopped on the bike. He said, "Anything doing, Johnny? Can you tell me anything about next week?" I said, "No, not at all. I don't have anything." I literally had it in my inside pocket, but I obviously wasn't going to give it, share it. So there'll be a lot of those kind of meetings with fellow advisors, with the Taoiseach's advisors, with the Tánaiste's advisors, and with some others. And then occasionally you'd have to attend. We attended the Fine Gael Education Committee meeting, or the Parliamentary Labour Party meeting with Rory. It was questions on education that he wanted me to be there for.
And when would he contact you, as opposed to contacting, say, a civil servant, or as opposed to contacting his press officer? Sure. Or, you know, how does a minister decide?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I mean, every minister works in different ways. With Rory, every Monday morning we would have a to-do meeting, and Rory would we would devise the agenda for us, the stuff coming up that week that we'd have to get done. Now, Rory is very brisk, brisk in the best sense of getting things done. He's not a waffler. And after 40 minutes, you see him kind of looking at his watch.
You said in your book that he keeps the watch on the inside of his wrist, so he'd keep an eye on it.
Keep an eye on it, yeah. And if it's going on too long, or people are waffling, he'd look at his watch. So you got the message. So you were brief and succinct and to the point. And he was right. If you don't get it done the first hour, you're only delaying time. So he very efficient in running meetings. So we would have our various tasks assigned for the week, and he was, I say, quite efficient about that. So you'd be quite busy the rest of the week then, and you do a little bit of the weekend. I try to contain that because there's no point in walking yourself into an exhausted state because you're not just very productive at that state. Yeah.
But still, there must be a lot of adrenaline running when there's things happening.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. I mean, what surprised me was the immediacy of so many things and the way the system reacts to stuff in the media, much more so than it would appear to journalists on the outside. It does react, you know, the Secretary General or officials would react and the ministers would react, whether it's in another department or the Taoiseach people would react or the Taoiseach people would react to something that affected us and reflected on the government in some way or another, either badly or to the good. So that you'd have to help prepare a response if there was any queries about it, draw memos for other ministers if they were going to be asked about something that, if they were out that day with the media, that they'd need to be briefed on. It was some issue that was in the paper that on education that they'd have to respond to.
So who do you think then has more influence on government policy? A newspaper journalist or editor in education or a special advisor to the Minister for Education? Well, I'm just taking on board what you've said, a lot of the agenda is set by the media.
I wouldn't overstate it, but there's certainly no doubt that some of it is, yeah, in terms of reaction by the government to stories. I think the agenda is set by the government itself, but it gets thrown off course by some development in the media. But no, I think the ministers and their officials and lowly advisors do set it as well, though. Yeah. But something in the media will have an impact on the course of that, the implementation of that policy.
So, well, I mean, if I put it another way, do you think you had more influence as a special advisor or... And I know you spent a lot longer as a correspondent and editor, but where do you feel you had more of a handle?
Oh, I would have thought as
more of a shaping.
Yeah, I know I would have thought as an advisor, certainly. I mean, it is an extraordinary privileged position to be in, because I mean, for donkey's years, I've been looking at. I was always fascinated by the intershaping of policy by individuals and personalities, how personalities shape policies. But on the inside, you just see how true it is. You know, I mean, you can have the fine theoretical treatises on how policy evolves, but when you see it in the raw, you realise its personality drives a lot of policy formulation. And the personality of the minister and his or her interest in a particular topic will drive the evolution of that policy and will fashion the response of the officials as well to it. So that, look, there's no doubt as an advisor you do have a considerable influence, particularly if you're dealing with a minister who's open to taking advice.
Because you said also there that you were kind of surprised at the fast pace of how things happened, but still in your book you said that you found the pace of change very slow.
Well, the pace of change is slow, I know that there's almost two speeds. The pace of change is slow. I mean, we painstakingly slow in some areas. I mean, there's no doubt areas like the divesting, it's taken far too long to get to any decent number of schools being divested. I think it's about happening in about 8 areas at the moment, which is still far too slow. I mean, the principle has been established, which I think was what Rory wanted to do. Other areas, the change is far too slow as well. I mean, he achieved, I think I was very happy though with the way things worked out, particularly in terms of setting up Solace. I mean, for me, the setting up of Solace and the education training boards possibly is Rory's most significant legacy, if we do develop, as it is hoped, a decent further education and training system, you know, as a real option to higher education, because we are a bit obsessed with higher education and university education in Ireland, almost to the exclusion of everything else. I mean, it's very commendable that we have one of the highest participation rates in Europe in higher education, but that's partly because we don't have a sufficiently well-developed and well-regarded system of further education and training.
You wrote in your book that traditionally the Department of Education and Skills seemed to focus very much on primary and post-primary, whereas one of the more distinctive features was the in Rory Quinn's ministry was the interest in third level. Could you say a little bit about that? I mean, you were thinking particularly, I think, of the technological universities.
Ah, yes, indeed. Yeah. It's not just the department. I mean, successive ministers are invariably interested in primary and second level. I have a particular interest in third level, and I convinced Rory that this really is where we need to devote a bit of time to. Because if you think about it, if we have a successful higher education system, it does act as a draw for foreign direct investment. It helps develop indigenous industry in Ireland. A good research base is a big attraction in the country. Enterprise Ireland or the IDA would certainly confirm that. So we do need to consider greater investment in higher education. Unfortunately, for the past few years, I mean, the investment wasn't possible because of the scale of the financial crisis that the government inherited, and higher education suffered badly in terms of cuts over the past few years. It's still suffering badly. So I got Rory interested in the whole higher education area in a number of spaces. One was the whole point system. I mean, I gave him a printout. I said, Rory, just look at this. You know, 20 years ago, there were whatever it was, 200 or 300 CIO options. You look at it now, it's 1,400. And just the exponential growth in CIO course choice is confusing for a 17 or an 18 year old trying to fill in a CAO form. We're kind of trying to distinguish between mechatronics somewhere and electronics engineering somewhere else. So we really have to tackle this problem, this issue. He looked at me and said, Can nobody do anything about this? I said, no, it's just grown topsy-turvy and nothing has been done about it. Now, happily, the Higher Education Authority, the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment were equally concerned. So there was a conference held in September of 2011, and as a result of that, some events began to flow and a group was set up and has been looking at that. I think there will be some changes, as you know, in the point system and some changes in terms of the number of course options that the universities are offering. I mean, UCD has led the way, and Maynooth is doing so, and I think Trinity would cut the number of options as well. So in that regard, we certainly had some success. Other areas we didn't have success in.
And on next week's programme, John Walsh will talk about some of the areas where Rory Quinn's tenure as minister had less success. If you'd like to comment on this or any programme or suggest a topic for a future programme, please write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can listen to over 250 podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.